Accession number 4488, Reel 9.
Brigadier O'Flynn, Reel 9. Was there anything else particular you remember about Marn?
Yes, one of the very special memory of Marn was the number of visitors we had down there, especially in the months after Christmas of January and February, because at that time it had become the done thing for people in Cairo to motor across Sinai with the intention of getting to Aqaba and then seeing the Wadi Rum and eventually arriving at Marn as a prelude to visiting Petra, the rose city half as old as time. Well, as both Ian Fernie and I had been in Cairo for 3 years before going to the Transjordan Frontier Force, a large number of our friends and many others decided it would be a wonderful opportunity for them to do a trip boating across Sinai to Petra, dropping in at Marn to see us. And so I can remember particularly the spring of 1934, where we had 7 visitors in 1 month who came to see us, and they arrived there. They all said, "Where's the hotel?" knowing full well there wasn't one, and so we would say, "Well, stay with us," and so they stayed with us, and our guest rooms were always full. Now, in addition to those visitors, later in the year, Petra was visited by almost every important person in Europe at some time or other. And during my time there, I recall the following well-known people. I remembering one Winston Churchill coming down. And we heard he was about. He arrived with the RAF he accepted our invitation to stay in the Zirka Mess, in the Marn Mess. And I remember breakfast when I was up, and I offered him breakfast, and he said, "No, he'd have a brandy." I was most impressed by the man, a very kind man, a most interesting man. And in addition to that, another day, a summer's day, I think it was the early summer's day, an aeroplane arrived from Amman with a senior RAF officer. And a very gracious and glamorous lady came in to have a mess with us. It was Lady Louis Mountbatten, who'd come to see Petra. And shortly after she had gone, a few days later, the next week I think it was, independently we had the 2 richest girls in the world to stay. Both arrived by air out of the blue, and both somehow or other came to the Transjordan Frontier Force mess. One was Barbara Hutton, and the other was a Doris Duke, or Doris Cromwell. I know that she was one of both at the same time, but all that was interesting. Another visitor there, when I was there, was the Crown Prince of Sweden, who was doing an official visit. When he arrived, we had to mount a guard of honour. I had to command that guard, the Crown Prince, the Crown Princess, and one of the princesses had to be accommodated in Gurkha Goodwin's little house. So it was a place which was full of interest, because there were many people passed through from Cairo and other places, and we always seemed to be having new faces to entertain us. And as I said earlier, that in addition to Chota Goodwin's house, which had 3 bedrooms, I think, Ian Fern and I each had a guest room at the end of our respective blocks, so there was always room for about 4 visitors to stay in Marn. It didn't cost a lot, because in those days, on the princely salaries, which seemed to be us to be princely, of £50 a month, running our own little messes, we seemed to be loaded with money. And all we were doing was saving up for coming home, getting married, or whatever it was.
Was the food you had in your mess local?
Yes. When I say less, we used to get the most wonderful mutton from the local butcher there, chickens, and a certain amount of fresh vegetables. But it was also a contractor in Jerusalem called Spinney, who used to send up on the weekly train from Amman certain pre-ordered commodities. And we also had a standing order with Fortnum and Mason to send out every 3 months or so a ham and various other delicacies. So we really lived very well on very little.
When did you leave Man?
Well, in April 1935, we'd finished our two-year stint down there, and so D Squadron from Zerka moved down to Man, and we moved up to Zerka. Thereafter, life went on as it had done in Zerka before, the same visits in the desert, the same patrols, the same everything. Later that year, in November, I had to return to England because an old rugger injury in my wrist was giving much trouble. An X-ray showed I needed another operation. And as this was to be done at St Mary's Hospital in London, I came home on leave for the operation and returned to Zerka again in February 1936, where I found that Ian Fernie had since become adjutant and been replaced in the left half M squadron by another chap from my regiment, Lieutenant Colonel J.F. Miller. The first really a noteworthy incident that occurred in 1936 was the start of the troubles in Palestine. As far as I can remember, that shortly after the full parade of the Frontier Force, with an inspection by the High Commissioner, General Arthur Walkup, in Zerka, where the whole force paraded except one half squadron left in Marne, was the dispatch of Peter Miller and his half squadron to Jericho to support the civil police in the maintenance of law and order at that part of the Jordan Valley. 2 weeks after Pete went down, I was ordered to take my half squadron down to relieve the left half. The trouble in Palestine was then increasing, and it was decided that the whole of M squadron should be moved to the Jordan Valley on active service to operate under the jurisdiction of the officer commanding British troops in Palestine. Our role had then moved from that of supporting the civil police to supporting the military power. Our task down there at that time was then to attempt to prevent gun running across the River Jordan from east to west, also to stop, arrest, and hand over to the civil police any armed men entering Palestine.
Where were you based when you were doing this?
Initially, the squadron headquarters was in Jericho, the Russian buildings.
And what were the Russian buildings?
It was an old school building. Originally, I think, started by a Russian mission. And after the end of the First World War, fell into possession of the Palestine government and was merely used for some purposes such as this. Our area to be covered was a very long one. As far as I remember, in all, it was about 60 miles. It extended from the northern end of the Dead Sea, although it included the Jewish Potash Company works in the Dead Sea, right up to about 5 miles short of Baysan. And when the whole squadron was moved down there, the squadron leader decided he would have his headquarters in Jericho, with one half squadron with him and the other half squadron based on Jiflik, and our initial task was to carry out daily patrols and nightly pickets, daily patrols up and down the Jordan Valley, occasional day pickets on the high ground overlooking the crossings of the Jordan, and standing patrols on the numerous fords and crossing places on the River Jordan between the northern end of the Dead Sea and Baisan.
How did you set about those patrols?
Well, they were originally divided. There was a half squadron at Jiflik taking on the area up to Baisan and to our meeting place. I can't remember the actual name of the place now, memory fails me, but about 5 miles south of Jiflik, and the half squadron in Jericho going up from the meeting at that point. Now, this was done. We had to really assess the situation as a result of information. What we knew where the crossing places were, we knew where the fords are or were, and we also knew the pattern of movement roughly, but the difficulty was to be at the right time and at the right place when there was any crossing, and it didn't get us very far. We went on doing it. Now, early in June, Chota Goodwin decided it was time he took his 4 months leave in the UK. He'd been due for it for 2 years, and he went home and command of the squadron in the Jordan Valley depended upon me, and I carried on as Chota had been doing. But in addition to that, I was also given certain tasks to perform in Jerusalem. And I did the various activities by a daily visit to Jiflik to discuss the situation with Pete Miller, to discuss the various patrols we were going to carry out for the next 7 days, how we were going to vary them, and where he was to put various night-standing patrols and I was to put night-standing patrols, because honestly, that the task we had was completely beyond the availability of troops. Just considering what we had, there were the total of 4 troops, 2 heavy troops and 2 light troops. Now, a light troop patrol had to consist of the 3 vehicles. You couldn't do a patrol worthwhile with under 3 vehicles, because you had to have 1 in movement, 1 static, and 1 following up the rear and passing on. And the 2 heavy troops could not really produce more than 4 standing patrols on the ground. You couldn't have a standing patrol of less than 1 NCO and 5 other men. And so it was an impossible task. But we discussed it with the police, and we discussed it with others. We knew the main crossing places, and we had to hope that being on the main crossing places at various times, the regular times, we'd meet something. We saw any number of people crossing, but we never picked up anybody with any weapons. I also noticed quite early on when we would do a patrol, because sometimes I'd send 2 cars out and I'd take 1 other car in my Buick and make an extra patrol, and I noticed that as I went along the west bank of the Jordan, I could see bonfires indicating my progress on the other bank. This was understandable. I remember 2 major incidents well. One concerned Pete Miller and his half squadron. I told them to sit on a rather prominent hill controlling the pass which led across the River Jordan and then on to the road from Jiflik to Nablus. He went out there one night with a complete troop, and that troop was attacked. I cannot how it happened, but I had a sentry all night on my headquarters. There were very light signals, but we did not see the very lights, or we should have seen them, But at any rate, I heard about it the following morning when the helio flashed back to me, which our communication up there. I went up. I saw that the amount of bullets on the ground, there obviously had been a lot of bullets fired, but the only hole I could find was in Peter Miller's car. Another incident was when I was going along the Jordan Valley one day, driving my staff car, escorted by one of my light-armed cars. And as we rounded a corner, I ran into an ambush. I didn't know anything I'd run into. Thing. I suddenly saw some men in front of me, and as I saw it, there was a loud explosion behind my left ear. It was my orderly, Ali Hussein, sitting in the back, seeing that these people ahead looked hostile, cocked his gun and fired it. I'm convinced he saved my life, because the other man was about to shoot me. But fortunately, Ali Hussein didn't hit him. And there were no awkward questions to be answered by the police at why a member of the Frontier Force had opened fire. But that was a very reassuring incident for me. It may be a silly and trivial one to report or recite, but I had been extremely worried ever since I moved down to the Jordan Valley, and I realised that here was I, with Pete Miller and Chota Goodwin, trying to require Arab soldiers to stop their own kith and kin from coming into Palestine, and we might at any time require them to halt and fire at some of their own people. And this little incident indicated to me that I really had nothing to worry about, because if one soldier, an Arab soldier, would up a gun and shoot at a fellow man, Arab, I need not worry.
Did you sometimes wonder the fact that you never came across anybody crossing the river?
Yes, I did.
Due to the fact that yes. You had Arab soldiers?
It may be an unkind comment or criticism now, but at the time we worked so hard in conjunction with the police, where we knew people were crossing, and yet however hard we tried, we never seemed to catch anybody. And I sometimes had doubts as to whether my chaps were letting them through. If they did, I couldn't really blame them, because I've often thought what we as Britishers would do if we were really faced up to a situation where we had to shoot our own kith and kin. And here I must quote another thing which is not relative to this, but I have a number of Rhodesian and South African cousins, the children of my uncles, who as a result of long service in the British Army moved to Rhodesia and South Africa, and I have cousins of South African and Rhodesian citizenship now, and I often wonder what would have happened had I been a soldier in the British Army and been placed in such a position that I had had to shoot those people. And today, I think this is one of the problems that must be confronting many soldiers, or have confronted many soldiers, in the event of such a situation arising. I don't know whether that's radical, but this is the thing I feel very strongly about.
In Palestine, did you have special instructions about when to shoot and when not to shoot?
Oh, yes, very, very strict instructions. One was hardly ever allowed to shoot. One had to go through the official drill. But I mean, it was really quite impossible for the Arab soldiers to do all that. I mean, therefore, we hoped they never would shoot.
What was the official drill?
Oh, well, it is the thing the same today. You must give warning, blow a whistle to all the other things. They do in Northern Ireland today. But in those days, I mean, there were certain facts. I did raise this at the time. If we were given, we were told to maintain a standing patrol over the river, and people refuse our orders to halt, and we had to fire, we should damn well fire. But fortunately, that situation never arose.
How closely did you cooperate with the police at this time?
Very closely. We had a local police chief in Jericho, and I had, in fact, the Russian buildings was bang opposite the chief police station. I had with a personal friend of mine, the Arab in Jerusalem, and at Jifflick, our headquarters was in the police post, sir. So it was very close tie-up with the police. We also, naturally, the police had telephones between their various stations, and we all worked hand in hand together. There was no trouble at all. And also, I had the most perfect relations with the mayor of Jericho. He was a friend of mine, once had a bit of a barney with him, got a bit angry. He threw nails on the road when my car was going along. I was very rude to him. And he even swept the road up for me afterwards. No, but we had the most perfect relationship with the Arabs, dignitaries out there, and the Arab population. I could walk through the streets of Jericho and everybody would say, Saida, Saida, Saida Bek, Saida Bek.
So there's no obvious hostility to your
cars? None at all, because the soldiers were there. We used to meet each other. I didn't offer them shine grease or anything like that, but otherwise everything else. And there were also one or two civilians in Jericho of Jewish nationality. We knew those. We used to keep a friendly eye on them. I used to go and have a drink. But there was no hostility to anybody at all in Jericho, to anybody.
You mentioned a Jewish potash factory in the North Dead Sea.
Yes, that was at the northern end of the Dead Sea. That was a bit of a headache.
Why was that?
They were always screaming, demanding protection. And we did what we could, but it was limited. On one occasion, I didn't get to give them all they asked. So they had a fire. But I'm perfectly certain it was a self-started fire to give us extra protection. But I was not very sympathetic, because they had a lot of ice there, and yet they would not let me or my detachment have any ice at all. So I was a bit upset with them, and I said, no, you can't bloody well help us, I won't help you. I will protect you as much as I can, but I cannot. I couldn't spare the chap to put a nightly guard down there. And eventually the British, when the British moved in, you know, the 1st Division came out from, they did put a detachment down there, but I hadn't the men to spare.
Your task at this time, therefore, was simply patrolling the river?
Our task was to prevent incursion from east to west across the Jordan Valley by gun runners and to apprehend anybody caught in possession of a firearm. There was nothing going the other way. It was all coming in.
You mentioned earlier on something about tasks in Jerusalem. What were they?
Well, this was rather an unofficial task, you see, that it helped me, because it was very lonely down there and very difficult. And once a fortnight, I was required to go up to Jerusalem, sit in the King David bar, have a meal and listen to the chit-chat. Because as a result of being out there, you see, one got to know a large number of people in Jerusalem who frequented the King David bar. So I had to go up and just listen and hear anything. And if anything worthwhile came to my ears, just to pass it on to the intelligence officer of the brigade down there, what was happening.
Who would be the people you'd be listening to?
Anybody in the bar talking. Anybody, you see. Mostly even the Arabs talked English down there. And I could speak a little Arabic. But I happened to know some of the Arabs, interesting, who were on the other side. I can't remember their names now. Some famous. They were pals of mine, drinking pals of mine. So one used to go down and listen. But I also remember one operation. There was going to be some gigantic dragnet operation. It was known that two or three chaps who was turning up all the trouble were in the Jerusalem area. So it was decided to use two battalions of infantry, the Cameron Highlanders was one, plus two troops of the Transjordan Frontier Force, light troops, do a sweep operation. And I was sent up to do this. I wasn't told what we were going to do, and I went to the King David bar, as usual. And there I heard the whole operation being discussed by British officers. And how there was to be this scoop, this sweep, that various people were going to various things, and we had to pick up so many things. So when I went to the operational briefing the following morning, I heard the whole of the plan outlined I'd heard the previous night. But needless to say, having carried out the operation, we didn't pick up a single sausage. But I let that know, you know, and that was a typical example of loose talk, because in those days people didn't know about this. That's why, looking back at hindsight now, it was surprisingly how badly trained we were, really, in many aspects.
Where did you get your intelligence from?
Well, one got a lot of intelligence from the police and other people living in Jericho. It's surprising where, if you know people, you get information about what's going on. A lot of intelligence was passing. We used to have chats with the police. They used to tell us what they knew. And some of the inhabitants in Jericho used to talk, and what they knew, that sort of thing. But I would merely listen to what I heard in the bar. If I thought anything worthwhile had come up or people were talking too much, I used to tell this pal of mine, this intelligence officer, and went on again.
Were there any other British units operating in the Jordan Valley when you were there?
Yes, afterward, when the division came out, I can't remember. They had all sorts of people all over the place. There was my favourite operation when the Navy came in. When, for some unknown reason, they decided that they wanted a mixed force to be based at Jifflick. I was to command it. It was my own squadron, a detachment from the cruiser Sussex, with a dismounted naval gun on a three-ton lorry with a bridge vehicle behind, a platoon of the York and Lancashire Regiment, and a half squadron of cavalry from Baysar. And I can't think what we were doing, but I knew we had to keep on going round in circles up at the Baysar area. The sailor never fired his gun. The Yorks and Blanks didn't do anything, and after a week we were told to go back to normal activity. Another operation I remember was the pipeline was constantly being, the oil pipeline running across to Iraq in the north Transjordan was constantly being blown up, and someone had the bright idea that we should mount a mobile patrol up and down the pipeline every night. Well, having done it for a week, going out every night at 8 o'clock until 6 o'clock in the morning, going up and down, having the pipeline pierced every night, they realised there was nothing we could do, because you merely had to watch these vehicles trundling along without lights. You knew where they were coming. You couldn't put a vehicle by itself. It could be three chaps, but you'd be shot up by whatever it was. And as soon as one had passed, half a mile away, the pipeline behind would go up. So that was cancelled. But it's interesting to note, when the British were doing that, they were attacked several times. But when we were doing it, we weren't attacked. I think, again, he was Arab, not wishing to fight Arab. Nothing we could do, because I used to go out myself on this thing. And we used to up and down, deadly dull, gang up. Damn frightening, too. Because they could see you and hear you coming along, but you could just had to trundle up and a plunk behind and the pipeline had gone up. But that's about all. Otherwise, it was very interesting, very boring, very tiring. In the end, just about the time Chota Goodwin was due to return from his leave, it was just after he returned, one of my soldiers had done something naughty. I've forgotten what it was now, but at any rate, he had to be remanded to see the commanding officer, John Crystal, who was then commanding. And during the course of the commanding officer's investigation, I had to be there to give evidence. I fainted. And I was carried out, and the doctor said I was suffering from heat stroke and complete exhaustion. So I had to be carted up to Zirka and was told not to go back to the Jordan Valley. But fortunately, my time out there was almost up, and 4 weeks later I left Zirka to come back to England to rejoin the home establishment.
I'd like to ask you now, Brigadier O'Flynn, looking back, what did you think the relationships were between Middle Eastern personnel and the British within the Transjordan Frontier Force?
I thought they were excellent. I can think of no possible grounds for conflict of any of us, because my own batman, I mean, who when I left and said goodbye to him, I then found him waiting at the steps of the gangway when I arrived at Portside to catch the ship, to make quite certain I was there, bringing with him a gift from his wife, whom I'd never met, to my wife, whom he was about to be bride, whom he'd never met. And Also, when I said goodbye on my final day, it is when I left the force, and the squadron paraded, and I wandered down and shook hands with each one of them. Some of them were crying. And at the end of the parade, Hamdi Beck would be my senior local officer, and then became the guide, was present, to give to me a magnificent silver cigarette box, subscribed for by the whole of the squadron. And this wasn't just me. This was, I think, the general relationship between all the British officers out there and the Arab soldiers. And to follow that up, one of the Arab officers in my squadron, Yusuf Beck, subsequently got the George Cross in the last war. And he was over here 2 years ago with his two sons, and we all met together and had a jolly good chat about it. I think the relationship in those days was very good. And I think it is due to the different way of life, different opinions held by people today, over things such as how the British got on and how they didn't. I've also noticed this in Europe. When as a young subaltern I did a certain amount of travelling about Italy and France, wherever I went as a young man, I was also automatically treated with considerable respect. Not that I was anybody special, I was just a Britisher touring abroad, and the British were respected. Now I go abroad twice a year on my holidays. I'm horrified at the way the British are treated, but I think we deserve it, because I'm horrified by the behaviour of men in my own Britain when I see them abroad.
About that, were there any trouble among some of the British officers who ever came to the Transjordan Frontier Force?
I don't think so. I cannot remember any, because, you see, we all live so miles apart, but I only remember one chap coming home early, but what he came home for, I don't know. But I never remember anybody being unpleasant, because, after all, the commanding officer at that time wouldn't have tolerated it.